Welcome to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Rocca. Given the trumped-up fears against ordinary Muslims during the past many months, it seems a good time to rebroadcast a program I first aired back in April of 2012. I called it My Son, the Muslim. In the early 1980s, not long after reaching his 20s, Patrick Rocca went to Europe to work and to adventure. He returned home as Muhammad Rocca. Sitting in one of Astoria's busy coffee houses, I asked him about the journey that led an American kid to Islam.
I was attracted to spirituality or spiritual things and felt the desire to search for what I felt was the truth for me. And my parents had always encouraged that. In college, I'd read about different philosophers and different religions, and I had read a number of books about Taoism and Buddhism, and a number of books by Alan Watts. Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to go work in Europe for the summer, and as I was flying over, I read the last book Alan Watts wrote, and in the book, he died before the book was finished, and so his best friend and one of his co-teachers finished the book for him. Mm-hmm. And in the book, his friend confided in the book that Alan Watts himself had said that the only time he could relax and feel really centered was when he was drunk. And it struck me very hard that how could he be teaching about meditation and all these techniques to people when he couldn't practice it himself. It was something I felt that if I'm going to learn or follow somebody, I want to follow somebody who's practicing what they're preaching.
Right.
Not just preaching a technique that they think might work, but haven't been able to do it themselves.
Right.
And I ended up bicycling through Europe and traveling through Europe and ended up in Turkey and saw a tourist brochure that talked about a great Turkish philosopher named Jalaluddin Rumi. While, as some people may know, Rumi's quite a bit more than just a philosopher. And I ended up visiting the museum and the mausoleum where he is buried, and I had what you might call a spiritual experience there, that I actually had a peace in my heart that I found when I was visiting there that I had not found anywhere else. And it was on this path of Rumi, on this path that you might call Sufism, that ended up leading me down to Islam and to study more about what Rumi was about and where he came from. For those who don't know, Rumi was an Islamic Sufi mystic who was born in what is now Afghanistan and Central Asia. And his family had to flee from the invasions of the Mongols to what is now Turkey. And he had many teachers in his life that he studied the outwardly aspects of the religion, but he had teachers who taught him about really how to get that close connection through love with his Creator.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the path that really that I found touched my heart.
At the time, did you have an inkling of how this was going to change your life, not only in a spiritual way, but in a practical way, that you were from being an American kid, you were going to be seen by many now as sort of the other, someone who was different, someone who was practicing or doing something that they didn't understand? And did you get the sense it made people uncomfortable around you?
Well, I spent the first time when I was studying this in Turkey and in Syria and Cyprus when I was traveling, I basically dove into the swimming pool. I didn't test the waters beforehand. and you know, when we come now to the present environment, it's a wide variety of different perceptions people have. I mean, you have a wide variety of peoples that are Muslim and different practices among them and all different types. They're not monolithic. There's many, you know, there are people who are very spiritual and there are people who are not, just like any other religion.
And you've had quite a bit of time now to absorb all this because you've been practicing Islam now for how long?
For 29 years.
29 years. So you're not a newcomer.
Not a newcomer, no.
When you first came back to the U.S. and you pronounced yourself, a practicing Muslim,
What kind of reaction did you get from people?
Well, I had a double culture shock when I came back to the U.S. If you spend time overseas, and especially at that time in the Middle East in the 80s, which was, you know, much more isolated from the U.S. than it is today, when we've got the internet and texting and Google and Facebook that's right. Really made the world a lot smaller. Coming back to the U.S., I had a double culture shock, because I had one culture shock of coming back to the U.S. itself and the fast pace of life and you know, the big cars and the big streets and everything, which was, it's a little mini culture shock you have if you've been away for a period of time. But I also had a culture shock in dealing with the Muslims here in the U.S. that I found at that time, the majority of them were not always spiritual. A lot of them came, most of the, like a lot of immigrants, they either came because the countries they were coming from were, you know, were either had difficult situations or could have been war. And a lot of them came for financial reasons, to better themselves financially. So it wasn't always the people you might run into who would be the most spiritual or most contemplative, but people who were here for finance,
right?
And so they may have come out of a religious background, but like people of every religion, it's, you know, we're individuals and humans, and in large part, they were not always very spiritual.
Yeah. Well, it's an important point in many ways, because I think some people want to stereotype Muslims just as some people want to stereotype others and see them as all the same and all. You know, for some people, all Muslims are terrorists.
Well, in some ways, it's the same difficulty every ethnic and religious group has faced coming to the U.S. I know, having grown up in Fresno, learning the stories of what the Armenians went through, and how you had large parts of town where people would restrict in their deeds the ability for Armenians to buy property in those areas of towns, and the struggle they had to go through to be accepted. And you know, from our family background in Chicago, you can look in terms of what the Polish and Lithuanian communities went to in terms of having to become accepted, or you know, almost every ethnicity that's come as immigrants in waves has had difficulties and had to prove themselves. You know, even to the point when JFK was running for president, he had to give a speech about how he was not going to be beholden to the Pope and follow what the Pope issued for edicts that would be trumping what he as president would have to be doing. And so I think it's an experience that many different groups have gone through, and one that the Muslims who are from multi different cultures, and you have Indonesian Muslims, who Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world, and people don't always realize that they're or from India, or from Pakistan, or from Bangladesh, and you know, all these different countries share the religion of Islam, but they have different cultural norms and different cultural practices and different languages that they speak. Similar to Catholics from Ireland and Catholics from Italy,
right,
share Catholicism, but there's quite a bit of differences in cultures and practices between them.
Well, and African Muslims seem to celebrate in a different way, and their different cultural
exactly.
practices, much more music, more dance, more, you know.
Yeah, there's many, many, many variances that you find among each group of people, and Muslims have those same differences and diversity.
Well, despite the culture shock when you came back, you did find some good spiritual Muslim leaders that you were able to spend time with here, and some good teachers, I think, right?
Yeah, I had the good fortune of spending quite a bit of time with some people who were Sufi Muslims in the Bay Area, and that was very beneficial for me, and I really enjoyed it. There's a number of them there.
Can you explain the difference between, there are sort of the two major types of Muslims that sometimes are at odds with each other? The Shiites, is it, and the Sufis?
Sunnis,
I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, it's Sunnis.
Clarify a couple of those terms. The Sunni Muslims are those who follow the example of the Prophet Muhammad,
mm-hmm.
And honor him and his family, but don't believe in a blood lineage for the spiritual successor.
Mm-hmm.
Where the Shiites believed in a blood lineage, that it had to be somebody who had a family tie or was a descendant of the Prophet Muhammad to be the spiritual successor or leader of the Muslims. And that's the main division. Mm-hmm. The Sunnis make up about 80 to 85% or possibly more of the Muslims, and Shiites are about 10 to 15%.
Well, coming up to the present day, one of the things that prompted me to want to talk to you is I was receiving an email from a friend that was a stereotype of Muslims. The email was all about Muslims and terrorism, and it's Muslim males who are doing this and Muslim males who are doing that, and why does the Transportation Safety Administration have to check any of the rest of us at the airport, because we know it's those Muslim males who are causing all the problem. How do you feel about that? What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think the TSA has done a wonderful job of upsetting the maximum number of people possible with how they've implemented a lot of the inspections. I mean, to the extreme of how you had senior citizens in wheelchairs and toddlers being fully searched. I think a lot of that's done to really upset a lot of people who are traveling, and I can understand that completely.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all suffered, all Americans, because of these sins of a few.
Right.
And it was a horrible thing that happened on September 11th in New York. And it's going to make waves and really affect all of us in a lot of ways. And I can understand TSA trying to do the best job possible in whipping together a government agency in an extreme short amount of time, and really having a shortage of training hours and shortage of time to really train their staff well. So we run into a lot of problems where you've had mothers being denied carrying, you know, baby's milk on board, or having to drink the milk to show that it's really milk. So, you know, there have been a lot of strange examples that are extreme examples that have left a bad taste in everybody's mouth.
Can you help people understand how I know you can't speak for all Muslims. Muslims are different like everyone else. But how the Muslim community in general feels about things like September 11th, feels about things like terrorism, feels about things like murder in the name of religion. Is that something that most Muslims would support, or?
I think I'm going to use an analogy. I think it's very similar to how you'd say the majority of Catholics might feel about the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
That most of them don't support violent actions. There might be a very, very small percentage that do, but the vast majority don't. And they feel sort of hurt from two different sides. They feel hurt that their religion was maligned in the first place by people claiming to do this in the name of religion,
right?
And something and feeling that they have nothing in similarity with them, and then also then feeling that then things are turned around and they're blamed for what somebody did. Maybe a better analogy would be to look at Jim Jones from San Francisco, who was a Christian preacher who of a very bizarre sect who went down to South America and ended up killing I believe it was a U.S. senator. But we don't turn around and blame all Christians for the actions of Jim Jones.
Right.
We do realize, and you do have people. And people have, you know, in most cases, the majority of people in most places are good people, but you have a certain percentage that are bad.
Mm-hmm.
And that small percentage that are bad can create a lot of problems for people.
Well, in both of the examples you chose, too, it was people sort of pretending to do something in the name of religion in terms of what they did, and I think that's the other thing.
It sort of becomes a antithesis of religion for people to be killing in the name of something when you look at every prophet, whether you look at the Prophet Muhammad or the Prophet Jesus or the Prophet Moses, peace be upon all of them, what they taught was very different than what a lot of their followers practice.
Right. I think a lot of Christians can relate to that, you know, equating what is done versus what the teachings are.
Right. And a lot of times, sometimes people who are trying to promote a particular narrow viewpoint or a particular ideology may use the common terms of the people in their area or culture. And if religious is a strong influence, they may use religion in a way to influence people to their particular ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have areas where Islam is predominant and people feel a strong attachment to that. You do have some people who manipulate that.
So the bad guys basically try to use that.
Yeah, people who may become, have their ideas askew, may use that in a lot of different ways to promote their particular ideology.
Right.
Or particular viewpoint, or their frustration or anger, or whatever they're dealing with, and take it out in a way that's not healthy.
In other words, you have to agree with me because I'm going to pretend that what I'm suggesting that needs to happen is ordained by God or something.
Right. Well, if you're not following it, you're a bad person of whatever faith that is. I mean,
yeah.
If you were in Jim Jones' community or those who were influenced by him, if you didn't follow exactly what he was doing, you weren't a good Christian. And a lot of people, you have the majority of people who are trying to do what they think is best, and you have a small number of people who manipulate that to negative ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've got 29 years to look at this. How do you feel about which direction we're moving in now? Are things, do you think, getting better or getting worse in terms of our ability to understand each other and to appreciate and accept one another?
Both.
Both better and worse.
Yes. I think you're seeing a polarization in general all around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're looking at politics, where you're finding the far right and the far left are far more vocal than the a moderate majority. I think it applies in religion. Karen Armstrong wrote a very good book about religious extremism called The Battle for God.
Mm-hmm.
And she covers the extremists in religious movements in a number of different faiths in terms of what drives them, what motivates them, what causes them to act in the way they do. And she came from a background where she was a former Catholic nun.
Mm-hmm.
And has written a number of good books about different faiths, and gives a very good balanced perspective.
Mohammed's wife, Lulu, is an Arab woman whose parents came from Kuwait and Lebanon. I talked with her about Muslim women and what's known as wearing the veil.
You've got the hijab, which is what I wear. Hijab is the covering that only shows the face. And that is what's been prescribed for women in Islam. Then you've got the niqab, which is what covers the face except the eyes, and that is not Islamically prescribed, although you have some Muslim women who wear it. And then you've got the burqa, which covers the face, all the face and the body, and that also, again, is not Islamically prescribed. It's merely a cultural manifestation. Back to your question, Roger, on why I chose to wear the hijab.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was, for me, it was a decision that I chose on my own terms. So I didn't have any male relatives in my life coloring my decision to wear it. And also, my mom, by whom I was raised, was a divorcee and also very trendy in terms of Western fashion and practices. And no one in my family wore the hijab, so it was a place that I had come to on my own. Up to that point, the life that I had led was one that was mostly with non-Muslim habits, given that I was raised by a mother that wasn't completely, religious. And also from my family, like I said earlier, none of them wore the hijab. So, and I was born in Australia and spent, part of my youth in Europe. So, I had adopted Western practices and ideologies. And so, up to that point, I lived like a non-Muslim, and my habits included partying and dating. And so by the time I reached 30, my introspection led me to realize that I was still searching for happiness, mm-hmm. and that the life choices that I had made up to that point were not getting me to where I wanted to be. So, the things I wanted were to have was to have more meaning in my life. I wanted to get married and to have a good man as a husband, and also to have satisfaction for my soul. And so, you know, I looked at my life and I'm thinking, well, I'm all the things I'm doing are not giving me what I want. So I thought, well, you know, let me see what Islam has to offer. So I coupled that with my learning of it, and I think I knew somewhere inside of myself that it might actually offer me a way of acquiring what I wanted. So in time, I had to let go of some of the old habits that I had and just replace them with Islamic ones, which took time, and it was not an overnight change, and it was definitely not one that my ego was so willing to let me experience. Wearing the hijab was one of those major things.
What kind of reaction did you get from family and friends and so on when you made that choice?
Well, when I first told my mother that I decided to wear the hijab, she was surprised. I think she was taken aback, given that I was never raised with the expectation of wearing it. I don't think it ever crossed her mind that I would. So she asked me, you know, if I was sure that this is what I wanted to do. And I said yes, and she said, okay, you know. And she accepted it from the get-go. And I think now, you know, it's been, I started wearing it in 2007. I think she's proud of me. She realizes that, you know, there is a benefit to it. My dad's family was not as open as I thought they would be. And, you know, given that they are, you know, they're Lebanese, and they just not too long ago came out of a civil war, which involved a lot of religious conflict. The Lebanese are at a point where they're trying to embrace nationalism over religious differences as a unifying point, and that religion is a private matter between a person and their creator and should not be something that is worn for all to see. And this was, you know, my aunt's opinion when I asked her what she thought of my veil. And, you know, and sometimes my cousins will tease me about it a bit, you know, but, you know, I think they've gotten used to it now. And I think also it surprised them too. You know, I'm of them, so... given that they're not so religious either, they never thought I would wear it. But so you see, it goes to show that I really had no influences that pushed me in that direction. It was something that was completely of my own choice.
The hijab is an outward manifestation of deeper changes that you made and getting further into your religion and so on. What has been the result of that? How has it affected your life? And you were going to tell us a little more about that.
For me, I feel it's given me some peace. You know, it's allowed me to reevaluate my self-worth. Prior to wearing my hijab, I think like a lot of women of today, I'll be honest, I'll say I based my self-worth on how attractive I looked. And this is something that the media fuels. You know, they're constantly bombarding women with what is the beauty standard, and it's all this focus on the external appearance, and that, you know, if you're not beautiful, you know, you're not made to feel you're worth something. And so, you know, by wearing it, it's given me some peace from all of that, you know, and it's allowed me to focus on who I am as a person. You know, it kind of in a way reminds me of the school uniforms I used to wear in boarding school, which I think is great. It puts the boys and girls on equal footing, and there is no distraction of superficialities and appearances. You know, you're all wearing the same uniform. You're all on equal footing with each other, and you're not you know, more focus is given to one's character. And so it's sort of the same thing in a way. And also, when I interact with men, it gives me a better platform for doing so. Like I said, I feel it puts me on equal footing with them, because at that point, I am free from male scrutiny and standards of attractiveness. And as a woman, it's my assertion that my physical person, that the judgment of my physical person plays no role whatsoever in my social interactions. So, I think that's what it gives me. One of the most common misconceptions that I hear about, or that, you know, I come across, is that, you know, the hijab is oppressive, and that some Westerners, you know, have chosen to understand the hijab as an oppressive, as an oppressive thing, when really what is oppressive is when it is enforced. And I don't believe hijab should be something that is forced on a woman. Islamically, it's prescribed for women, yet at the same time, as you know, as God states in the Quran, there is no compulsion in religion. You cannot force religion on people. Therefore, you cannot force a hijab on women. And of course, you know, you force anything on a person, they're not going to accept it. It's going to be against their will. So it's not. It's going to turn out bad. So it works good when it's something that you want. Wearing a hijab is not about shame. It's about modesty and privacy. I value my privacy a lot, and I think that's where the misunderstanding comes in. And that, you know, if you look around today, there is very little privacy, very little modesty left. So everyone wants to know everything about everyone, what they're wearing, the tabloids, the media, and all that. So, you know, then again, it offers you a way out of all that. So it's about privacy more than anything, and modesty. I find that the Americans are a lot more accepting of women who wear hijab as opposed to the Europeans.
Hmm.
I think Americans are a lot more tolerant, and even if they don't understand it, they're a lot more open about it and accepting. So I'm thankful. I'm thankful for that, and I'm thankful to be in a country that allows me to wear my hijab in peace.
Thank you to my son and his wife, Muhammad and Lulu Raka, for letting us look at Islam from their perspective as Muslims. You've been listening to the rebroadcast of a program first aired in April of 2012. Thanks for listening to The Human Beat. I'm Roger Raka.